Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. So many good books, so little time to read them all. But all I want to do on these sultry days is to plop down on the couch and read a good book. So today we'll run through a whole host of interesting titles with our group of literary wizards known as the Book Doctors. They are today Jeffrey Ann Gowdy is a writer, editor, and reviewer. And Jeff, always good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Mark Luce is chair of the English department at the Barstow School. He teaches at KU. Mark, nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
Katie Stover is director of reader services at the Kansas City Public Library. Katie, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
And Steve Paul is back in the saddle. He edits the Star's book page. He once owned a bookstore. He knows a whole lot about Ernest Hemingway, and he's here right now. How are you, Stephen?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for having me.
You've been
back.
Checking out some books websites of late. What are you picking up out there?
Oh, there's just all sorts of things going on. You know, it's hard enough just to keep up with what's coming out day in and day out. And then just a couple days ago, there's a fairly fun literary website called The Millions, kind of young and hip and an outlook that really takes books seriously. They put out a very helpful list the other day of the most anticipated books of the second half of 2013.
Whoa.
As if we haven't had time, to get through the first half
of
2013. But it was fun to kind of look ahead at some of those. Some of those I was aware, a lot of these books that are coming out the rest of the year, we're anticipating with Thomas Pynchon and Jhumpa Lahiri, and one of my go-to books for this fall is going to be Daniel Woodrell's new novel, which I just read, but we can't talk about it because it's not out yet.
What is the theme, the topic?
The topic, it's another Missouri story, and it's a historical one based on actual true incident. The Woodrell's novel is called The Maid's Version, and it's about it's kind of a mystery story. It's kind of a character study of people who are affected by the explosion of a dance hall in the early 1930s in rural Missouri.
And anyway, he of course is the author of Winter's Bone.
The author of Winter's Bone
a movie and everything
exactly,
else.
Yeah. Yeah.
That happened in his hometown.
Yeah, exactly.
That explosion.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
So, anyway, not to get ahead of ourselves, but we are getting ahead of ourselves, and that book is coming out in early September, and I think it's going to be a winner.
If you haven't read Daniel Woodrell, spend some time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good place to spend some time.
The Winter's Bone, in the fall, I'm teaching a class on American Noir at KU, and rather than just go with the usual suspects, your Chandlers, Keynes, and Hammetts, I've expanded more toward contemporary stuff, so I'm going to do Winter's Bone in that course.
It's a great book.
Oh, yeah.
Mark Luce, never satisfied with the status quo, always reaching, always going beyond around the next corner. Yeah. Katie, Jeff, anything on your radar screens coming up for the fall?
I'm pretty certain I brought one of the books on that list, Night Film by Marisha Pessel, and I'll talk about that in a little bit.
That's supposed to be the hot title for August, right?
Yes, that's why I brought it.
Where do you guys go to sort of keep up on what's coming out? Because there are, it is hard for book lovers to sort of anticipate what's happening. You show up at Rainy Day Books or somewhere else, and suddenly, where did this book come from?
My digital mailbox is filled daily with hundreds of emails from book publicists and Publishers Weekly, the magazine, and other outlets.
You're a book editor, though.
Yeah, and I also my desk gets stacked constantly with what are still published, the seasonal catalogs of the various book publishers. And the good news is that there are fewer and fewer publishers, so that there are fewer and fewer catalogs to page through. And I barely have time to kind of look at those, but occasionally
But where can the consumer go to sort of try to keep up with the flood here?
I also brought in The Millions. I think The Millions is a really great and helpful site. As a book reviewer, I consult that.
TheMillions.com, is that what it is?
Or?
There's so many books that come out, and you need some sort of screening device unless you want to plow through a lot of catalogs.
This new website, Goodreads, my neighbors are talking about it. my friend Jesse Peterson down the street talks about Goodreads all the time.
Goodreads, not exactly new. You can think of it as an online catalog for your own library where you can put in your own comments. You can rate these books, and there are certain Goodreads users who are followed by a great many folks who offer wonderful suggestions. They are able to describe a book in a way that has a follower say, yes, you read what I read, so that's why I follow you. You can also make your own lists on Goodreads and call them things like books that I didn't like, but everyone else did, or books that, I have one of those books that I will recommend from now until the world ends. Good books for book groups, good books for teens. There are lots of different ways that people are ranking their list, paranormal, not Twilight, lists like that. And a lot of readers are checking out those lists because these users keep them updated and they become well-known in the Goodreads community for
the thing that makes me suspicious of sites like that is people spend so much time, you know, offering their opinion that I can't imagine that they're actually reading books. And that...
Interesting, because I went to a session on that very topic at BEA, hosted by the National Book Critics Circle. They're talking about a code of ethics for book reviewers. Mm-hmm.
Meaning people literally review books not having read the entire book on somewhat reputable sites? Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is that there's a difference between reviewing and suggesting. And reviewing is what Steve does. It's where you look critically at a work and you are evaluating what the author has done. You're evaluating the writing style, the characters. Did they meet the intents they set forth? If you're suggesting, you don't have to like something you're suggesting just because you know what the appeals are. Most of what's on Goodreads, I wouldn't really call it reviews. I'd call it suggesting. Those are folks who are picking out the elements of a book that they know will appeal to other readers.
Well, it's also very highly self-selective. I mean, you know, most of the reviews you're going to read, or not reviews, or suggestions that you're going to read on there are going to be either just absolutely vicious or, you know, praise that really is sort of hyperbolic at best. I mean, you get only the people who are truly excited or truly angry are going to go and sort of spend that time for free, which is the part I never understand.
But if I'm hearing some consensus around this table, the website themillions.com appears to be a site that several of you are saying is
it's
a good
reputable.
Place.
It's a reliable, reputable site with serious considerations of contemporary literature and that kind of thing.
Also, it's a good preview site. Yeah. So like as a book reviewer or Steve, as a book editor, we would look for books before they come out. Goodreads is after the books come out. Here's what's available.
For criticism, I would say I still like Salon. I think Laura Miller does a good job for them. They got an irreverent streak, but they're also serious.
Yeah. I mean, there are still remaining, major book review, outlets like the traditional ones in the New York Times and the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, and new outlets have popped up as well, and some regional newspapers that I can think of continue to take a stand and try to keep up with what's going on.
But I think you're talking about the Kansas City Star.
Well,
right?
that'd be one.
Raise the flag for the home team here. Yeah, let's go to some good book reviews here today from our book doctors. And Katie Stover, start us off with Night Film.
I'm glad you're letting me talk about this one first. It's the second book from Marisha Pessel. She wrote Special Topics in Calamity Physics, and that was a best book when it first came out in 2006.
Special Topics in Calamity Physics? That's a novel?
That was a novel.
Okay.
And Steve is nodding, so I bet he read it and liked it. Night Film is very different. This is on a damp October night, a beautiful young woman is found dead in an abandoned warehouse, and her death is ruled a suicide, but this investigative journalist suspects otherwise. He's going to probe the strange circumstances of her death, and the reason he's so interested is she's the daughter of an extremely reclusive, cultish film director, Stanislav Cordova, and he makes all these crazy horror films, the kinds of films that make you look deep into your soul. And we were talking earlier, maybe depressing films, but certainly thought-provoking. And there's been a great deal written about this gentleman's films, but not a lot about him. So this journalist wants to investigate, well, why did this woman kill herself? Did she really kill herself? And he's delving into the family's background. And this book just takes you into Cordova's eerie, hypnotic world.
Wow.
It takes you to a remote Adirondack estate, a hidden little speakeasy in the Hamptons, and a cult shop in Lower Manhattan. And it's compelling. It's very thick. It's got recognizable characters, and it's got a pretty speedy plot. There's also lots of snippets from newspaper articles, film stills, mysterious websites. I guess there's a hidden internet I'm not aware of, and that plays a big part in this book. And the author has just done a really creative job of putting illustrations and other elements to boost her story and help it move along. Wow. She's doing a lot of showing, a little less telling, which is wonderful.
Which is the way you're supposed to do it.
Right. It's the way you're supposed to do it.
Now, easier said than done, obviously.
She manages it. And her stories are just unusual. As you're reading her books, you know you've never read this type of story before. It's completely unpredictable. You might think you know where things are going, and you have no idea. So even the most experienced reader won't be able to pinpoint what's going to happen next.
And that book, again, is Night Film
by Marisha Pessl.
There's a real trend in literary fiction toward the thriller, toward the more dark thriller.
Oh, definitely. I'm seeing that.
Yeah.
Let me just offer just a contrarian point of view here. You know, so much of fiction, it strikes me these days, is, you know, murders and dysfunctional families. You take those two ideas off the table, and sometimes I wonder, what are you left with out there these days? And you're going to take exception to that, Jeff, but do I have a point or do I not?
I think you have a point.
I find myself frustrated with the world of fiction given that, because that doesn't reflect my world, at least that I'm aware of very often.
Nobody's going to write a novel about you, Steve.
Well, because
you come from the happy family. and as we know from Tolstoy, all happy families are alike, and it's the unhappy families that make fiction.
Well, and I get that.
Because conflict. And the essence of fiction is conflict. But
the whole sort of taking the road down to the murder of the dud, the mystery, that's such an easy thing to do. I'm looking for something else at age 55 here in my life. Mark, am I right or not?
I will not comment.
Yeah. Okay. But does fiction have an issue, a problem, Jeff,
I think even happy families here have a lot of tension. It's the tension that has the interest for people in general.
I think that in some respect, if you look at maybe a bestseller list or the things that sell, then perhaps you have a point. I think that there is still enough variety in the fiction world that isn't just, you know, prurient.
The Daniel Woodrell thing that Steve mentioned, that's intriguing to me.
Also filled with dysfunction
and sex and drugs.
Yeah.
It's the relationships between characters and people. A lot of authors are probably picking families because everybody comes from a family. At one point, you came from one and you've got a beef to pick with somebody in your family. And so that's where most of these authors, I think, are starting. They're starting with a twisted dynamic, and they're just exploring. They're going out from that. And whether it's a person and their best friend, or a person and a teacher, or a person and their entire family. Because you can find crazy relationships between characters in every genre.
You know, there are all different kinds. Mark mentioned, you know, all different kinds of fiction. And you have your surface level conflict, murder stories, thrillers, and sex books, and that's fine. You know, in literary fiction, I think the hallmark of literary fiction tends to go deeper into the character and the psychological basis of human behavior and the heart. And even though stories, and they can be built on things other than that kind of creepy content that you're not too happy with.
Yes.
Yeah. If you consider that, I would assume that a decent amount of literary fiction is a reflection of a contemporary world. I mean, our contemporary world, while it might have a shiny face on it, and you scratch just a little bit, and it gets pretty dark pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And so, absolutely. I mean, to me, you know, I had a friend last time we were on, and they're like, why do you always choose dark books? And it's like, well, you know, because I think that's what's more fascinating. Yeah. And so, you know, if you, like, for example, so I have Apple TV and I got Sky News, and I didn't really know it. And so they've got basically the equivalent of headline news on. And so I watched it for an hour and was shocked that there was actual news on television. right, compared to sort of what we would see in the States, which would be like, okay, Steve's going to make a souffle now, and then we're going to talk about Kim Kardashian for a little bit.
Yeah,
and,
or a whole lot.
But I think, but I think, you know, I think that when you look around the world and you look at the types of conflicts that are happening in the world and the different kinds of disenfranchisement, I think authors in general sort of respond to that. And so to me, that sort of dark impulse is actually just exploring really the world around them.
Well, you take somebody like Alice Munro, who recently announced her retirement.
That's right. I read that story
and
in the Times this weekend.
She has the deepest, the most in-depth, the most layered fiction, and some of it is very dark. All of us, you know, in a given hour have dark thoughts, happy thoughts. I mean, she captures that sort of level of human consciousness.
Yeah.
It's just life.
Yeah. Well, I will now dismount from my high horse and we'll proceed with the rest of our book reviews here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with our book doctors today, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, Katie Stover, and Steve Paul. Let's move on here, Mark. Plays of Martin McDonagh.
Okay, so if you want to get away from the murder of mayhem, this is definitely not the place to go. So, in keeping with my reputation of enjoying the dark arts, Martin McDonagh is most of you probably know him as a filmmaker. He wrote and directed the fine cult comedy, I think it's a comedy, In Bruges, and then he also recently did Seven Psychopaths, which is extremely twisted and wildly funny with a great cast. Christopher Walken's in it. Tom Waits does a little turn in it. But before he wrote for the movies, he wrote a handful of plays, like seven or eight plays in a span of like 2.5 years. And they were a hit everywhere. They were a hit in London. They were a hit in New York. He was born in London to Irish parents. And his plays basically, all of them except one, take place in Western Ireland. And they are as twisted and violent and dark as any plays that I have certainly ever read. They cover angry young people who are disenfranchised. They're surprising, they're fascinating, they're shocking, they're controversial. It's almost like you took the violence of early Scorsese, like your Taxi Driver or your Mean Streets, that kind of rough violence, not necessarily the stylized violence of like Tarantino, and you shove them into a blender with Samuel Beckett, like the bleakness of Beckett, and then a little bit of the absurdity of Pinner, and just hit the blender. So I honestly have never read anything where I'm like, I can't believe that just happened, and have that feeling over and over again. His most famous play is The Pillow Man. But the one that I particularly liked was called A Behanding in Spokane. And when I first got the play, I thought it was beheading, and I assumed it was beheading the entire play because I just didn't look at it. And then this guy's missing a hand, and I'm like, oh, it's a behanding. The things that happen to these people are tragic in so many ways, and he really takes aim at really kind of the young and the stupid and the provincial. I've really never read anything like him, and I plowed through eight plays in the span of about 3 or 4 weeks, and kind of can't get enough of him. Like,
wow.
I wish there were more. I'll give a list to Steve, and we can put them on the, because there's eight, so I don't need to read them all.
Well, you sold that pretty well for as being as dark as it is.
It's twisted.
Even
when you think that, so like you're thinking like, okay, so this is really twisted. Okay, so it's way worse than that.
Just be prepared.
Just, you can't imagine the kinds of things that happen to these people.
Yeah, when you were talking about the blender a minute ago, you forgot to mention the cat.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
There's a cat involved.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a dog involved in another one. Body parts, guns.
The plays of knives. Martin McDonagh. Okay. Jeff, you want to turn to a book and a guest we've had here on the show, Cheryl Strayed. Her book is titled Wild About her long hike on the Pacific Coast Trail, her life-altering hike on the Pacific Coast Trail.
Absolutely. I know she was a guest.
Oh, she was terrific.
I bet she was terrific.
Yeah.
You know, this was an Oprah book, but I took the sticker off, so I don't think we can hold that against it. this is a memoir of Cheryl Strayed's Hitting the Pacific Crest Trail. She started at the Mojave Desert and went up to the Bridge of the Gods that connects Oregon and Washington. It really fits in the classic literature of quest, where a character undertakes a journey to overcome obstacles and gain self-knowledge. And I think what I liked about it, though, and the thing that's really compelling is how contemporary her internal obstacles are.
Mm-hmm.
She took this hike when she was 26 years old. And at 22, her mother had died of a fast-moving cancer at age 45, and she had hit rock bottom. She had begun to cheat repeatedly and wantonly on her husband. She dabbled in heroin. I don't know if you can really dabble in heroin, but she dabbles in heroin.
Yeah.
And her family falls apart. And when she absolutely has hit the very bottom, she thinks, I've got to save myself. So as a penitent, she goes on this massive hike. She's an inexperienced hiker. She has an overstuffed backpack.
And I love the opening scene where she's getting dropped off to begin the hike, and her pack weighs more than she can carry. And she's too embarrassed to be seen struggling to put it on in front of the guy who just dropped her off, who knows that she's in trouble.
Right.
But she just takes a few steps, and she knows her, you know, she's already getting a blister and the thing's too heavy, and
her posture is like a penitent. I mean, she's like hunched over. She can barely walk. But she sheds some of the weight, and she sheds a lot of her emotional weight and comes to a new understanding about herself. And I think she has a really emotionally clear voice. She reminds me of Anne Lamott.
Yes,
she's come by it
the hard way.
Comparison,
yeah.
She invented her surname, Strayed. Mm-hmm. She strayed.
Yeah.
But I think some of the pleasure of the book was diminished for me because I had earlier read Tiny Beautiful Things, which is a collection of her advice columns from The Rumpus, so I knew a lot of the autobiography. But I thought it was a really compelling read.
And she's so much in the vein of contemporary autobiographical writers who reveal so much about themselves. And there's really nowhere else. You leave the book knowing just about everything, I think. There really can't be many more secrets that you don't find out here.
Yeah, it's not in a salacious way, though. I mean, she has come to a deep understanding about herself. I would really recommend it. When I was reading it, I kept saying to my husband, you got to read this. It'll help you understand your students.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic in audio, too.
Is it?
Yes.
Does she read it herself?
No, she has another narrator do it for her, and someone who's not really well known. That's why the name escapes me. But there's a couple of scenes that are really rather scary. Mm-hmm. Cheryl, when she runs across the two weekend campers, and they seem kind of threatening.
Right.
And that's
the guys with the beer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the very tense chapters.
And I think folks can look forward to the movie, right? I think Reese Witherspoon or someone famous is going to play her.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think so. Yeah, it's coming. That book, again, Wild by Cheryl Strayed. Steve Paul, The Looking Glass Brother.
Well, from memoir to memoir, and there are some residences. This is a book by an old friend of mine. He used to live in Kansas City, Peter Vonsegaser. He actually wrote for the Star as a freelance back 20-some years ago. And I knew a little bit about this story some years later, but what I just read in this memoir that has just come out a couple weeks ago called The Looking Glass Brother is just phenomenal. It's just amazing. And it's the kind of book that I couldn't wait to get home to finish, to get home after work to read more of it.
Wow.
And it just took a few days to get through it. The unusual part of it, The Looking Glass Brother, Peter is writing about a brother who comes into his life, a stepbrother, whose name is also Peter Vonsegaer. And he's referred to as Little Peter, and the author is Big Peter. But Little Peter is a schizophrenic. And he's had a troubled life, and he lives homeless, and he pops up from time to time in drugs and alcohol. And he comes into Peter's life. Peter, by now, is living in New York, working a kind of writing and filmmaking and writing about art. And he has a young family, and he comes under Big Peter's wing, and it totally changes Peter's life, the author Peter's life. The title alone, The Looking Glass Brother, implies that there is another sibling to be talked about, and as this book unfolds, you realize this is also a book about Big Peter, the author. And what you learn about him and his family, he comes from a background of great wealth, kind of Gatsby-est, kind of a Gatsby estate on Long Island. His family and his grandparents, his great-grandfather worked in the J.P. Morgan empire, and there was great wealth, but there was also great dysfunction, your not favorite word, but and Peter has done a beautiful job of kind of weaving his family story and his family's many marriages and disappointments and self-destruction. There is a period that Big Peter goes through that I was surprised by, but he goes through a heroin period himself and climbing out of that and kind of colliding with his brother and ending up kind of in this limbo relationship was really fascinating. And wow. As a memoir, I haven't read anything quite like it before. It's beautifully written, and I'm going to highly recommend it. A little bit of self-service. Peter's in town later this week and is doing an event Sunday, 4 o'clock at the Boulevard Brewery.
You know, I've never heard you gush like that before. Brother Steve, you've just gushed.
Okay. And I'm so happy to do it.
Yeah, The Looking Glass Brother. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation, good recommendations here for lots of good books with our book doctors. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our talk with our techsperts yesterday about the latest in home technologies and the differences between Vine and Instagram, you can find it at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, the DVD gurus are back. Also, Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. Well, today we're visiting with our book doctors, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, Katie Stover, and Steve Paul. Katie Stover, you're up next with a book titled Visitation Street.
Visitation Street by Ivy Pachoda. I received this in a galley, I think, back in March, and have been telling everyone I know to read this book. It's wonderful. It's the second offering in this new Dennis Lehane line from Echo Books. They're an imprint from HarperCollins. And I've been telling friends, I always read what Dennis Lehane tells me to read because he's one of my favorite authors as well. And this book is very similar in tone and atmosphere to Dennis Lehane's own gritty crime fiction. So I'm not surprised that he's a fan of this and he chose this as his second offering. But Pachoda gives us a very tightly knit yet racially divided blue-collar neighborhood of Red Hook, Brooklyn. And if Red Hook sounds familiar, that's the town in Brooklyn that took the largest hit from Hurricane Sandy last October.
Sure.
And I was able to visit Red Hook while I was at BEA a couple months ago, and it's coming back. But this story takes place on a sultry summer night, similar to what we're experiencing now, too. Bored, but basically good teenage girls just take a raft and they decide they're just going to go for an exploratory boat ride. And they put this bright pink raft out on the East River and they just start paddling away from shore. And that's the last anyone sees of one of them. One of them comes back, is found hours later, washes up on shore, and no one knows what happened to the other girl. And while that's the mystery at the heart of this book. It is a bit of a thriller. It is crime fiction. What's really interesting about this book is how this neighborhood reacts to this tragedy. This missing girl, this other girl who can't, won't talk about that night. And how do the residents of this neighborhood react? How does this incident affect them? And the Lebanese bodega owner wants to turn his store into the little community information center for the entire neighborhood. And he's doing his best at that, and some of the neighbors are holding back. And the bar across the street where a lot of folks are gathering, and they're passing judgment the way neighbors do on the parties involved and what the Lebanese bodega owner is doing. And this other mysterious graffiti artist who seems to recognize the neighborhood and seems to recognize the residents, and no one knows who he is. So what's his place in this story? Why is he there? Why is he putting this beautiful art on the various buildings and bridges and stonework in Red Hook, Brooklyn? So Ivy Pechota just takes all of these elements, and Dennis Lehane called it an urban opera. And it really is an urban opera.
Oh, great.
As you're reading, you realize you will find out eventually what happened to the girls on that night, but it's how you get there and how all these characters come together.
Well, I want to know why the raft is bright pink.
That's a crucial detail.
Okay.
Because it will
sounds
turn
like girl
up,
power.
It will turn up later, and yes, it's very likely Ivy thought of a girl power thing.
All right. That's Visitation
or Child's
Street
Toy.
By Ivy Pechota.
Ivy Pechota.
Okay. Great recommendation from Katie Stover. Mark Luce, Rothko's Lego. Oh. No, I'm sorry. Queen Pin by Meg Abbott. I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. Megan Abbott is actually started off as an academic. She got her PhD from NYU and studied sort of questions of masculinity in noir fiction. Well, then she turned to writing and has produced four novels, I think, at this point, all highly acclaimed. This is the first novel of hers I've read, called Queen Pin, and it is absolutely refreshing. It's a real kick in the pants. It's a nameless narrator who tells us from the start, I want the legs. That's the first thing that came into my head. The legs were the legs of a 20-year-old Vegas showgirl, 100 feet long and with just enough curve and give and promise. Sure, there was no hiding the slightly worn hands or the beginning tugs of skin framing the bones of her face. But the legs, they lasted, I tell you. They endured. 2 decades her junior, my skinny matchsticks were no competition. So, off and running, it's the story of...
I've seen legs like that before.
Yeah.
Once or twice. Yeah.
So, those legs belong to a woman named Gloria Denton, who's basically a do-it-all for... of mob figures in what appears to be sort of the West. And our narrator is working as basically cooking the books for a small firm, and comes under Gloria's wing and is introduced into this world of crime and shooting and danger. Gloria is basically about as tough a broad as you could imagine. And, then our narrator falls in love with a fellow named Vic, and then things kind of go, and Vic owes money and all over town. And,
yeah.
In terms of story, I mean, we've seen this before. I mean, it's the protege trying to take on, to learn from, and then eventually topple the mentor. The thing that I like about Abbott is that the language is just fresh. I mean, it's this one's written in first person, kind of later, and she's good. I mean,
wow.
I've read a ton of crime fiction that's not good, and this is fresh, and the language is good. And even though it's set in the past, like you never quite get the time frame. It could be anywhere from kind of the 40s to the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But she's it's just magical and a super quick read. Her name's Megan Abbott. Next year, she is going to be this year, I guess, she's the writer in resident at Old Miss.
Wow. Hmm.
Which Queen is weird Pen. It's like a New Yorker going down to the South to write some.
Shake things up.
Yeah. Hmm.
Queen Pin by Meg Abbott, right, Mark?
Yes.
Okay. Jeff, Good Kings, Bad Kings, and lots of kings in between.
Good Kings, Bad Kings. It's a novel by Susan Nussbaum. And she was a playwright who actually, in 1978, at the age of 24, was hit. And she I read somewhere that she said it wasn't a hit and run. It was a hit and fall down. And she became wheelchair bound. And she also became involved in the emerging disability rights movement, wrote a lot of plays. All of her plays were produced except for what she considered her very best play. And when her very best play, which was filled with disabled figures, as a lot of her plays were, was not produced, she quit writing for a while. And then she put a lot of that into this book, which was chosen as the Bellwether Prize winner for socially engaged fiction, which is now the Penn Bellwether Prize, founded by Barbara Kingsolver, addressing issues of social justice. Now, here are people who come from fractured families, but this book has such incredible spirit. And the voices are just incredible. It is narrated by seven characters, and all but one are disabled, and they literally jump off the page. The residents include Yesenia, who is saucy and sassy and ends up in this institution. It's all set in an institution for disabled youth. Ends up in this institution because she bops somebody on the head who insults her. There's Teddy, who lost the use of his legs and most of his arm mobility when he had a surgery for a brain tumor. He's very naddily dressed. He wears suits every day. And he's been classified as mentally retarded or mentally challenged. And he doesn't experience himself that way, and we don't experience him that way either. There's also, among other residents, the Good Kings or the Bad Kings of the book's title. These are the caretakers. And there's Ricky, who is a van driver and also kind of a cop who doles out discipline but doesn't fairly, and he gets involved in a romance with Joanne, who's the anchor character, who's possibly the stand-in for Susan Nussbaum. And that romance is handled very sweetly, but Susan Nussbaum has an ear for language. This is really colorful, really lively language, and I would very much recommend this book. I don't have the hardback because my nephew took it off my hands. Oh. But anyway.
Got to get it back. Good Kings,
and
Bad
also,
Kings by Susan Nussbaum.
I should say I reviewed it for the Kansas City Star, and it is the current selection of the Kansas City Star Book Club upcoming that Katie conducts.
Yes, it'll be on July 22nd. If anyone is intrigued by Jeff's suggestion of that book, give me a call at the library, and we'll get you signed up for the book group. This was also fantastic in audio as well. It's even better in audio.
Yeah. Well, if our listeners want to chime in with their recommendations for great summertime reads, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. And if all that's too tough for you, tweet us at @kcurupdate. Steve Paul, tell us about the new book from Neil Gaiman.
Gaiman,
The Ocean at the End of the Lane.
Yeah, I can't pretend to be a Neil Gaiman expert there. I'm sure many listeners out there have read all of his books and love him like like the champion writer that he is. He writes for adults and kids. But I was totally charmed by this book, which I read the last few days. One of the reasons I read it is it's very short. It's under 200 pages. And apropos of our discussion about fiction earlier, it represents kind of another strain of fiction, that being the fairy tale and fable. And we don't see too many of those in contemporary literature very often. And I was suckered into this one and really taken with it. This is the story of a 7-year-old boy whose kind of life and memory is transformed over a period of days, but especially one night when, as things happen, he visits with a family of women down the end of the lane from his house. And magic begins to happen out in the grounds around that house and in the little pond that is referred to by one of the characters as the ocean, thus the title, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. I don't want to go into too much detail because as it unfolds, I mean, I don't want to spoil the kind of the experience, but a character develops. There's kind of a ghostly characters and witchy characters, and these women, including the 11-year-old girl Letty Hempstock, who she and her mother and grandmother turn out to be kind of guardian spirits for this seven-year-old boy. And this is all being retold by a man 40-some years later. So middle age, he goes back to revisit this property, and this kind of flood of memory comes out about this transformation and this magical experience, and a horrible experience, too. I mean, it was very frightening occurrences that involved evil spirits, I would say. But it all kind of sort of works out in the end, and there's an kind of an unhappy thing that happens, and it has totally transformed this boy. And he wonders whether it has changed his life or not, or whether he could really change as a seven-year-old, but you know it really has. And it's a touching, it's a charming story.
You don't hear about
the language of it is very calm and easy. I compare it a little bit to the only other book I've read of Gaiman's, which is Coraline, which is about a young girl who's encounters kind of a magical experience in a house by going through a door.
So this is adult fiction.
I would definitely say it's adult fiction.
But
I
mean, could be read by...
It could be read by older kids as well, or could be read to younger kids. It's certainly in the form of an adult novel. And I think he kind of plays with his own audience that way. And he expects, you know, it's the kind of book that I think adults would very much enjoy. I mean, people who know me might be totally, you know, kind of surprised that I enjoyed this book.
The Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman.
Yes.
Okay, great suggestion.
And it's a big hit this summer and definitely worth a read.
So he gushed and he liked kind of a almost sentimental novel.
He's getting soft.
I love it. 816-235-2888 with your recommendations for great summertime reads here with our book doctors, Cheryl from Independence. Cheryl, good morning.
Good morning to you guys, fellow book buddies. I wanted to tell you about a new book by Eli Brown. I came in late on the show. You might have already mentioned it, but it's called Cinnamon and Gunpowder by Eli Brown. High pirate adventures at sea in the early 19th century. It's smart and it's thrilling. It's just a wonderful read.
Katie Stover was nodding her head vigorously as you said that.
Oh, that book is so charming.
Yeah. It's just a terrific book. So,
okay, Cheryl, I'm glad
reading.
You called. Thank you very much. Yeah,
bye-bye.
Just a few minutes left. Mark Luce, what do you want to pitch in here? Anything else you want to toss in?
Well, the thing that...
You've always got something else to toss in.
I always have something else to toss in. I teach art history, and so we're doing modern this year, and so I always start with Rothko, which is actually the end of the modern before we go back. And so I dove in basically to his life with two big books, James Breslin's biography of Rothko, and then a book by Lee Seldes about the legacy of Rothko and what happened after he died. He committed suicide in 1970, and the gallery that represented him, along with his kind of business manager, basically just gathered up all the paintings and then were actually sued by Kate Rothko, his 20-year-old daughter. And then this thing basically became the Watergate of the art world absolutely fascinating to watch the sort of machinations of how galleries operated in the 60s and 70s, which I'm sure they operate pretty much the same way now. So that's kind of the business end of it. But the biography, one of the things that Breslin does is he's fair. I mean, Rothko was not the most pleasant fellow. He was prickly at best. He had a measure of self-importance that is hard to justify, even with the sort of majesty of his paintings in the 50s and 60s. But a sort of fascinating look at a kid who came over to Portland in when he was just a young boy and grew up and spent some time at Yale, experienced a lot of anti-Semitism, moved to New York. He taught, he painted, he couldn't ever kind of seem to catch a break. And then suddenly in the mid to late 40s, started to take off. And then in the 50s, of course, he just explodes on the scene. A fascinating and deep look by written by Breslin, who's not an art historian, but I think does a really good job of dealing with the works.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming in with your great recommendations again today. Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, Katie Stover, and Steve Paul. All of our picks will be on our website, kcur.org, after the show. Thank you all very much for coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.